Kathy Reed is Director of Acquisitions Management, and Corey Rinder is Procurement Executive at the United States Department of State. My guests, folks, thank you very much for being here today. I appreciate your time very much. Let's start with acquisition priorities for 2014. We're past shutdown and we're past sequestration, and we have some certainty in the budget now. Corey, I'll start with you. Tell me about the priorities that you're establishing for the rest of this fiscal year and as you prepare to go to 2015.
Well, I think it would, first of all, be beneficial to understand some of the differences in the State Department acquisition posture, how we differ from other agencies. We do about $7.3 billion in goods and services, representing about 40,000 transactions. And our portfolio has expanded over the years as we've gotten into Iraq and Afghanistan. We have a primary acquisition office under Kathy in Washington, supported by some regional procurement offices in Frankfurt, Germany, and Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And we do have procurement operations at every embassy and consulate around the world. So we've got about 250 different locations. Kathy, can you kind of break down what our spend is?
Yes, we have about 25% of the expenditures per year is in overseas construction at the embassies and the consulates. And then about 25% relates to programs supporting diplomatic security around the world as well. Roughly about 10% of our spend is IT-related, and then another 10% is consular affairs, passport, and visa operations. State does about an equal amount of goods and services.
So that's, I'm doing some quick math, that's 70%, 25% overseas construction, 25% diplomatic security, 10% IT, 10% consular affairs. Of that, and you said it's about a 50-50 split on goods or products versus services. How has that mix changed over the years? Are you seeing the same kind of transition that other agencies are seeing, where they're moving from primarily products, primarily goods, to more of a services environment, Kathy?
We are definitely seeing that trend. I've been with State since 1999, so initially we had more supplies than services, I believe. And given the current state of world affairs, we have seen an increase in construction and embassies as well as security.
Mm-hmm. How has that changed the way that you go about the business of getting what the department needs?
It has changed because we're looking at a different program office structure, as well as a different acquisition structure. So there's additional planning that goes into those large complex procurements. And so the clientele and the acquisition planning function has been forefront now compared to buying basic supplies and basic IT stuff.
So with that breakdown, Corey, tell me more about the priorities that you're going to establish or that you are establishing for this year.
Where State Department gets unique is that we're operating in a global environment. And so if you look at some of the places where we do business, vendors in the U.S. know the U.S. government. They seek the U.S. government as a client. They want to build a U.S. government business. In many of the countries where we operate, the vendors consider us to be a very small part of the portfolio. So your ability to leverage in negotiations with those vendors, they may sell you one car. They may sell 1,000 cars to the other folks who live in that environment. So your ability to leverage the negotiations becomes challenging. That's where you need to see if you can become part of a larger global environment. Like if you have a local hotel, you're trying to negotiate with the local hotel, can you leverage their relationship with a global brand to get them to deal with you? Things like the Federal Acquisition Regulation, contractors here, they know it. They live it. It's the Bible. You're in an overseas environment. They deal with you once or twice, and you're asking them to access various databases, register in various databases for just a couple transactions. So that means our people need to be systems knowledgeable as well and do a lot of additional handholding for vendors that other agencies, they say, if you're not capable of doing business with us, not capable of registering, we'll see you.
Mm-hmm.
But this may be the only supplier that can satisfy a particular need. So that becomes challenging. And just the distance and the time zones, whereas vendors in the U.S. might be able to access a help desk, somebody in a different time zone, there would be additional challenges there. So that becomes extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean that you spend, that an acquisition officer in another location spends as much time helping the various potential vendors navigate the system as they do actually going about the business of bringing the materials, the goods and services into the department?
Absolutely, and you have to be very knowledgeable about the systems.
What kind of training do you have available for those folks? I imagine that is a pretty important part of cultivating this workforce who's able to do this.
We require for our contracting officers domestically to go through the regular certification program, all the normal contracting classes for federal acquisition certification in contracting. Where we've done it a little bit differently is we have foreign service officers who are, I'd call them the utilitarians at a post. They do housing, they do motor pool, they do warehousing, they do procurement. Usually they do procurement about 20% of the portfolio. So these people need to be trained in the processes that they're going to encounter at the post, but they also need a lot of help tools like templates and accessible forms, accessible experience that enable them to get things done quickly. One of the things we've looked at improving in the acquisition portfolio is the contracting officer's representatives. You have to think of it as a three-legged stool. So you've got the contracting officer who is knowledgeable about the business aspects. What are the federal acquisition rules? What's the extent of competition? When could you limit competition? What is a fair and reasonable price? How do you document it? Things like this. You've got the contractor who brings a commercial solution to the table. How can the commercial marketplace satisfy this need? How can the contractor's technical experience satisfy this need? The third leg of the stool is the contracting officer's representative. So this is the eyes and the ears of the contracting officer. This is the individual who really needs to define what is success. This is the individual who needs to monitor the contract for success and work with the contractor and the contracting officer to make things happen. One of the things that we did to try to move things along in a better direction was look at the way we train those people. How do we train the contracting officer's representatives? So what we did is engaged in the ultimate in self-torture. I sat in on our one-week class.
Okay. Ate your own dog food, I think
they call it. Ate my own dog food, and it was the finest in 1990s technology. PowerPoint after PowerPoint until you got glassy-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I quickly realized that what we needed was more adult learning. Centered training, more tools in how to actually do it. So what we did is we went in and revamped the entire course. We added more exercises, things like reviewing an invoice. Okay, how do you review an invoice? Well, you give people a lot of bad invoices, and you let them, like, where's Waldo? You let them find where the problems are.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you a question. How much is a lot of gasoline? Because we gave people invoices and said, okay, the contractor delivered a lot, one each, mm-hmm. lot of gasoline.
Yeah.
How do you know you got it? I know gallons. I know liters. But if you're writing a contract saying a lot of gasoline, how are you going to inspect that? And so as a COR, that teaches you, I need to work with the contracts people to have the contract define something that is identifiable, is inspectable, mm-hmm. is achievable, okay? We also looked at how you develop your requirements and how you define your requirements. So we used simple exercises like your rich uncle Henry died and left you a hot dog stand. So now you're too busy running your radio show to run that hot dog stand. You're going to hire a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define what it is the contractor should do? And we have groups doing exercises where you try detailed specifications. You tell them exactly how to check the inventory, exactly how many loaves of bread to put on the shelf, exactly when to sweep the floor. And what you'll get is exactly what your Uncle Henry had for 20 years. But if you define the end goals, I want a stock level of X, okay, or I want a clean bill of health from the health department, you'll find contractors will propose things like, how about if the bread vendor comes and he checks the status of your inventory, and he keeps your shelves filled. you don't even have to do the inventory. I'll keep your shelves filled. So you learn to take advantage of what industry has to offer. So looking at training and revamping the training was one way to do it. Also keeping all three of those legs of the stool together. So it's one thing to have training, but people have questions. So we assigned a contracting officer from State Department to be the course manager for that training. So when somebody raises their hand and says, yeah, but how do we do it here at State? Somebody who knows how it's done at State can say, well, here's the way it's done. And you can bring in contract instructors who are good teachers, but they may have a DOD experience or another agency experience that just doesn't hit it on point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that the course be a living and breathing learning experience, and the people are able to learn. We also had an aha moment at the beginning of the course when we were first auditing it. Lady raises her hand, got a question, first 5 minutes. Her question was, if I fail the exam, can I prevent my supervisor from making me a contracting officer's representative? Okay. And right away I knew, well, we got a problem here because these guys don't sense they're part of something bigger.
Mm-hmm.
They don't sense that this is an important function. So what do we do at the Department of State to make this a more important function? So the first thing we needed was a community, a sense of community. And so there was a homeroom created at our Foreign Service Institute for the alumni of the class to trade experiences. What's going on? What challenges are you seeing? What examples of best practices are you coming up with that you want to share with your fellow students? A semi-annual COR get-together, a COR forum. Misery loves company, okay? And it really is comforting to know somebody has it worse than you. So you look at your problem and you go, whew, I can handle this because I'd hate to be that guy. But the COR community gets together for a full-day seminar twice a year to hear experts from other agencies, to hear experience from other folks. That's really helpful. We've got an advisory board of CORs. We've got a database to track them. We came up with an annual award. Let's recognize people. Let's get a little publicity for a job well done. And believe it or not, actually adding a requirement to evaluate how you do as a COR as part of your performance appraisal, because many people have this as an ancillary duty. It's not full-time. It's you do your radio show. And by the way, when they deliver the furniture, you make sure the contractor did what the contract said. So if you're doing that more than 25% of your workload, you really need to be graded on it.
Kathy, tell me about the implications for managing these folks who don't do it full-time and who don't do it necessarily in the United States, where it's easy for you to communicate with them. What are the implications there at making sure that the agency's getting what it needs in all of these disparate locations around the world?
I think technology and communication have made our lives easier regardless of where we located. From my office, I have folks about 30 in Frankfurt and another 6 or 7 in Lauderdale, not to talk about every embassy and consulate that's overseas. So we focus on improving acquisition and then communication and collaboration as much as possible. Listservs, chat rooms, homerooms, all of those are available and always for us to help with. And then every time one of our senior contracting officers goes out in the field and our folks travel a lot, then we all get together and say, okay, what's going on in Frankfurt, in Afghanistan, in Iraq? And we try to cover the whole global perspective of every contract that's there so we can share. For the larger customers, both the construction and diplomatic security, we've actually embedded contracting officers with the program office, and that has been a great success. So we have total communication, total meetings. So you, instead of calling or emailing, you just go down the hall and you say, hey, we have a meeting. We need to talk through this. We have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because for us in contracting, there should be no surprises.
Right.
It's all a team collaboration approach.
That collaborative effort, you mentioned technology. I imagine that's really facilitated that incredibly, especially teleconferencing, things like that. You use those tools on a regular basis?
We do, very nicely. And we also have a total integrated logistics management system from beginning to end that serves as a requisition, acquisition planning, contracting tool, invoicing. And so we are able to reassign workload internally with a push of a button. We're able to track the workload that every contract specialist mostly has. And it is a worldwide system, so from the general services officer's perspective, you can see what anyone has at any given moment. It's made a world of difference for us.
But as great as technology is, I want to jump on your face-to-face co-location, because the ability to sit across the table from your contracting officer's representative and just talk it through. I've had experiences in the past where I've been a contracting officer. You get a piece of paper on your desk, you read it. Then you call the contracting officer's representative and you say, could you just walk me through what it is you want to buy? And the initial response is, well, it's there on the paper. And then you say, well, just take a few minutes and walk me through what it is you want to buy. Well, I want to buy this system. Okay, well, are you going to install it yourself? No. So you'd like installation? Yeah. Okay, are you going to maintain it yourself? No. Would you like a one-year warranty? That's the maintenance, and then maybe a maintenance contract after that? Yeah. You know how to work it? No. Would you like training on that? It's like, you know, would you like me to supersize this? Would
right.
you like fries with that? And so I think there's really no substitute for that face-to-face interaction where you've got the large programs, where you've got the large portfolio. I think having the contracting officer co-located is very beneficial. Could you talk, Kathy, about the local guard program, because I think that's a situation where the co-location, the face-to-face, has just yielded huge benefits.
I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, Corey and I are always brainstorming on strategic sourcing and what we can do better worldwide and something new and different. Every country overseas mostly has a guard service contract or agreement mechanism of some sort. So when we were looking at improving customer satisfaction and also increased collaboration and communication, we thought, why can't we centralize this back here in Washington? So when you look at it the way it was, every general service officer spent 25% on this local guard contract. Most of the vendors were DC-based or home-based here. So we took the initiative of let's bring some of them back here. Let's have a cadre of contracting officers that do just local guard. Let's have those contracting officers sit with the program office, which is our security office here in Washington, D.C., and let's standardize clauses, technical evaluation panels, statements of work requirements right up front, and let's look at the plan for 5 years, which ones are expiring, where options have to be exercised, and let's put this plan together. And can we do it in 3 to 5 years? So we pitched it at the highest levels in the department. We got the okay, and we moved out. The contracting officers loved it. It took a lot of work. We were on the road a lot. So we would look at solicitations. Once you got all the clauses standardized and everyone knew, we saved money, not a lot overall, but the companies got it right away that they could not talk to individual contracting officers overseas to see how all the options and all the overruns and administration would be handled, that in fact we had a centralized cadre here that was dealing with the same contractors over and over again. So we had better leverage. We reduced the burden of staff at embassy. It has been a win-win for the department.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and I would like to talk about the state of your workforce right now, your acquisition workforce. Overall, you know, people say, can you give it a grade? I'm not going to ask you to do that, but what are the strengths that you have in your acquisition workforce right now? What are the areas that you'd like to shore up? And what are the kinds of people, the kinds of talent that you're bringing in right now in the areas that you want to shore up? What are their credentials? What are their skill sets and so on?
Well, why don't we start at the low end? Because we've got a good intake program for interns. And I think the way Kathy's handling her interns coming in, it's really yielding good dividends.
We have an active intern program. We also direct hire authority, so we mostly always have vacancies available. Corey and I have structured the program because we both came from DOD on an 1102 training program with the DAU level 1, 2, and 3 certifications. But I think what makes us unique is we rotate our interns and our younger employees in grade, not in age, mm-hmm. through different divisions and program offices. So they'll do a stint of 12 months or 18 months in construction. They'll go to diplomatic security. They'll buy the pens and pencils. So they have a nice rounded career. But in addition to that, we focus on customer skills. You must be able to command and control the customer, so to speak. You must be able to write a good statement of work. You must understand contract administration. We also allow them to travel, and that is a huge perk. We don't want them to get bored. That's why Corey and I are both still with the department. It is a vibrant program, and we do something different every day, mm-hmm. and you can see the difference in your mission accomplishment. And that's what they're seeing as well.
So when you say, well, do you have ability to attract people? Do you have ability to retain people? The State Department mission is fantastic. It's really making a difference and making a different world. It's the opportunity to work with different cultures around the world. So we attract a certain type of person who is adventurous, who's looking to implement change. And so the interns we've brought in are excellent. The work ethic of the people, absolutely outstanding. The ability to go in and work and facilitate, very, very good. You know, if over the years, what I've seen are kind of two different types of people. You're either an artist. You can walk into a room. You can work the room. Everybody loves you. But I open your file drawer, and there's a stack of papers, and I can't figure out what the heck you did.
You've been in my office, obviously.
I've been in your office.
Thank you very much.
And then you've got the accountants. They've got everything filed by the middle initial of the person they're dealing with. But you stand them up in front of a group, and you say, I need you to run this meeting, and it just doesn't happen. What we're looking for are those Renaissance people that straddle both. You need to be a facilitator of the business deal. You need to be able to drive a meeting to conclusion. You need to be able to drive a program to success. But you need to be detailed-oriented enough that you can document what's going on and you can show that decisions you've made are solid business decisions.
Final thoughts. How do you rate the relationship right now between government and the vendor community that you deal with? Corey, I'll start with you.
I would say that I don't think the relationship has changed all that much over the years. I think we recognize that it's a business relationship and not a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
We recognize that industry has goals of profitability and return on investment. The government has goals of achieving its mission. There's some overlap there. But at the end of the day, there are some divergence of goals. I think the key is being clear in your requirements up front. Making sure that you've got a good communication process with the contractor and being timely in response. Because like fish, you know, time is not kind when it's just sitting there on the table waiting for action.
What do you think about the relationship, Kathy?
Oh, I agree with Corey. I think it's pretty much the same as it's always been. But I think the prenup is important as the proposal comes
yep.
in. I think the post-award is the honeymoon period, and you got to make sure that you have total communication and collaboration. So you have no secrets among or between the vendors, because we do a lot of multiple vendors included, and we try to just keep the lines of communication open.